And Radio Derb is on the air. Greetings, ladies and gentlemen, from your overwhelmingly genial host, John Derbyshire. Struth, it's feast or famine in this news business. Some weeks there's nothing to report on but some B-list Congress critter talking nonsense on an issue you don't much care about. Then, suddenly, there are two or three big fat stories all at once. It's actually been more like two and a half this week. The big two have been the conclusion of the Mueller investigation and the dropping of all charges against hate hoaxer Jussie Smollett. The generic headings there are, number one, the criminalisation of policy differences, and number two, black privilege. The half story in my two and a half is the vote on Brexit this afternoon. It's half a story because, in the first place, everybody is so utterly fed up with the endless wrangling over Brexit, it's hard to focus attention on it. And number two, to be blunt, because Britain's not a very important country anymore. The Brexit story is mainly interesting in a symbolic way, as a flag in the wind. The wind, that is, of populist, ethno-nationalist rebellion against elite multiculturalism that has been blowing through the whole Western world this past 3 years. I'll squinch in some remarks about the Brexit vote after the news comes through this evening. Meanwhile, some thoughts on the big two. The criminalisation of political differences is not a new thing in Anglo-Saxon government, as Peter Brimelow has reminded us. 300 years ago, parliamentarian Robert Walpole was imprisoned for a spell in the Tower of London, an episode he survived to later become Britain's very first Prime Minister, and one of the most successful. 2 years after Walpole's imprisonment, Robert Harley, the leader of the party that had imprisoned Walpole, found himself in the Tower for a somewhat longer spell, long enough to destroy his health, according to Dr. Johnson. Early 18th century British politics definitely was not beanbag. There are key differences between then and now, though. The foremost one is that Anglo-Saxon politics soon got much more civilised. By the end of that century, the criminal prosecuting of British prime ministers and American presidents was thoroughly out of fashion. It didn't really surface again until the Watergate crisis of the 1970s. Watergate is vivid to me because it was at the front of political news when I first arrived here in August 1973. I was living among Chinese people in New York's Chinatown. I was amused at how they all saw it in terms of the palace intrigues of Imperial China. "Who is the leader of the faction trying to depose President Nixon?" they kept asking me. Looking back on Watergate now, I think historian Paul Johnson nailed it in his 1983 book, Modern Times. Longish quote. By 1972, Nixon and the nation were already engulfed in the maelstrom of hysteria known as Watergate. America seems peculiarly prone to these spasms of self-righteous political emotion, in which all sense of perspective and the national interest is lost. The Watergate witch hunt was run by liberals in the media. In their eyes, Nixon's real offence was popularity. Though he won narrowly in 1968, he successfully appealed as president over the heads of opinion formers and a Democratic Congress to unfashionable, inarticulate middle Americans. Family-loving, church-going, patriotic, industrious, and anti-liberal. End quote. It's hard to miss the parallel with Trump derangement syndrome. A second key difference between Britain of the 1710s and America today is that it was the big names who ended up in the Tower back then. Walpole, Harley. The witch hunters of our own time are more skillful. They go after the small fry. In Watergate, Nixon did not go to jail, but Gordon Liddy and Howard Hunt did. Likewise today, it's not likely we shall see Donald Trump in an orange jumpsuit, but Paul Manafort and Roger Stone are having their lives systematically wrecked. In Chinese, this is called killing a chicken to scare the monkey. Overall, what we are seeing here is, as Peter Brimelow wrote, a regression to a much older, more brutish style of politics. The gentlemanly political exchanges of our grandfather's time are a fading memory. We live in a cruder, stupider time. The Russian collusion hysteria was, like Watergate, run by liberals in the media. Now that their efforts have apparently come to naught, we see them reacting in a way that professional anthropologists must find fascinating. What comes to my mind, watching them, is those end-of-the-world cults that appear from time to time. I wrote up one of the more amazing cases here at vdare.com 4 years ago. That was the Khoisa cattle killing in South Africa in the 1850s. A prophet came up among the Khoisa, telling them the world would be gloriously renewed and the white men would be driven into the sea. But first, the Khoisa had to kill all their cattle and scatter their corn. They obediently did so. But on the date the prophet had declared the world would end, nothing happened. What followed is very revealing about human nature. Some of the prophet's followers, disappointed, fell away. The rest doubled down. The date was recalculated. Another disappointment, another recalculation. There were several cycles like that, with a hard core of believers clinging to hope through each cycle. With their cattle all dead, tens of thousands starved to death at last. It's not likely that any of the talking heads at CNN, MSNBC, or The Washington Post will actually starve to death, but their disappointment must be acute. As with those other apocalyptic cults, some portion will fall away, while the hard core will double down. It's a cliche by now, but it's true nonetheless, that modern left liberalism has a strongly religious flavour. The impeachment and conviction of Donald Trump is, in this schema, equivalent to the rapture. All evil will be swept away, and the righteous will be raised up to sit at Maxine Waters' right hand. But who knows? Perhaps the new world of perfect justice and peace actually will arrive at last, and all we bad whites will be driven into the sea. Keep hope alive! The Jussie Smollett fiasco was the second big national headliner this week. It's been amusing to see so many commentators grumbling that Smollett got off because he is rich and famous. Smollett is not actually all that rich or all that famous. Had you even heard of him before he staged that hate crime? I hadn't. He is, though, black, or at any rate blackish, and he seems to be well connected in Chicago's mulatto mafia, that concentration of blackish power that includes Jesse Jackson, the Obamas, Valerie Jarrett, and other players. It was those connections that got the charges against Jussie Smollett dropped. The phrase black privilege is being thrown around in connection with this story. That's not altogether inappropriate. That Smollett's blackness, or blackishness, whatever, that it was an important factor in the charges being dropped, can't be denied. If you feel like you want to try denying it, first just run through a thought experiment where a white TV actor during the Obama administration staged a fake mugging by two white guys he described as black, wearing hope and change hats, who doused him with chocolate sauce while snarling, "This is Obama country." Right. Smollett is also a homosexual, and so he's a twofer, victimologically speaking. We all know how cruelly oppressed homosexuals are. That surely can't have hurt his case, though how much it actually helped, I have no idea. It was those connections to the mulatto mafia that helped the most, though. Since blacks moved into municipal big city governments in a big way through the 70s, 80s and 90s, Tom Bradley, Harold Washington, David Dinkins, Willie Brown, they have proved to be skillful players, advancing and enriching themselves and their co-ethnics in fine old Boss Tweed style. David Dinkins notwithstanding, my own nearest big city, New York, was late to this particular party. There is something bracing and fortifying in the air out there in the West and the Midwest that we just don't have here on the Atlantic frontier. We're catching up, though. A case of black privilege almost as brazen as the Jussie Smollett non-prosecution has been on display in New York recently. Next segment. The beneficiary of black privilege in this case has been Cherlaine McCray, the black wife of New York City's white mayor, Bill de Blasio. The city's first lady has, of course, never been elected to anything. On her husband's initiative, however, she was given management of a citywide mental health initiative called Thrive NYC, with a current budget of $250 million a year. Thrive was launched at the end of 2015. To date, it has spent $565 million of taxpayers' money. Was all that money well spent? Nobody knows. There seems to have been no attempt to evaluate the effectiveness of Thrive's programs. So far, the New York newspapers have found no successes to report, and there is no clear accounting of how the money was spent. $565 million. Under pressure from the public and local media, New York's City Council, which is a hive of far-left social justice warriors, the City Council has been looking at Thrive and questioning the First Lady. Very respectfully, of course. After a two-hour session with her, City Councilman Richie Torres opined that, quote, "We know as little about the program after the hearing as we knew before the hearing," end quote. The evening after that hearing, Ms. McCrae went on to a local radio station and denounced her critics as haters. The chance that anything bad will happen to Ms. McCrae for flushing $500 million of public money down the toilet is, of course, infinitesimal. She has black privilege. New York City politics is depressing to contemplate. Bill de Blasio is a simply awful mayor. There's nothing much political about that. Even left liberals say that he's awful. He's ill-informed and politically maladroit. He's lazy and chronically late, even to grave and important events. New Yorkers are so used to his tardiness, they don't even joke about it anymore, just roll their eyes. The New York Post gifted him with an alarm clock, but it didn't help. De Blasio seems now to be contemplating a run for president next year. And he's been on the road in Iowa and New Hampshire, arousing no perceptible interest from voters in either state. The New Hampshire event on March 17th drew a crowd of 20. 14 of those were on the panel, though. Only 6 people actually wanted to hear de Blasio speak. And yes, for the Iowa event, he was 11 minutes late. Politics aside, the guy is simply awful. Vain, lazy, and clumsy. Yet, city voters in 2017 gave him a second term, rejecting a smart and presentable opponent, a lady of considerable ability and accomplishment. What's up with that? What's up with it is an 18% voter turnout. If there is no pressing crisis, no crime wave, no impending bankruptcy, no 9/11, then New Yorkers, other than the public sector union workers who run the place, New Yorkers don't bother to vote much. And if they vote, it's for the status quo. De Blasio won in 2017 with around 12% of the vote. I don't know what the opposite of the word advertisement is. But whatever it is, where democracy is concerned, New York City is that word. Black privilege is in fact rampant in New York City. Another running story recently has concerned the city's special high schools. This is a handful of public schools, most of them specializing in science and math, that admit students strictly on the passing score of a standard written exam. You pass the exam, you get in. You don't pass, you don't get in. These schools and their admissions procedures are protected by a state law. Mayor de Blasio hates that law and is moving heaven and earth to switch the special high schools to holistic admissions. That word holistic is education speak for completely subjective, as Andrew Ferguson has pointed out. Why would the mayor want to do that? Why do you think? Those strict admission standards mean that hardly any blacks get in, few Hispanics, a decent number of whites, and masses of Asians. Discrimination! Stuyvesant, which is the most selective of all these schools, had 895 slots to fill this year. Blacks, who are 28% of the city's eligible students, got just 7 of those slots. That's 0.8%. 66% of those admitted to Stuyvesant were Asian. Asians are 15% of the city's eligible students. It's been depressing to read and watch local commentary on these numbers. Race realism is totally absent. Yet race realism offers a simple and complete explanation for the numbers. Black Americans test at a mean IQ around 85. Hispanics around 90, whites 100, East Asians 105. I don't know a number for South Asians, but it's probably between whites and East Asians. Given the magnifying effect out in the far tails of statistical distributions, big discrepancies like those that are evident in the Stuyvesant results are to be expected. You'd never know any of that from reading the mainstream commentators. None of them dares venture into race realism. That includes some of my own favourite commentators, like Michael Goodwin and Heather MacDonald. All they dare say is, "Fix the schools! We need better elementary and middle schools, so the black and Hispanic kids are better prepared." Those differences in mean IQ explain most of the school admittance numbers, I'm sure. In conversation around the city, though, and in comment threads on various websites, you hear about black privilege also being in play. Like this. Tony Private high schools in the New York area are keen to have a sprinkling of black students. They let them in on scholarships and waive the fees, just so that they can virtue signal in their promotional brochures. So, if you are a smart black middle schooler in New York, you have a choice. You can take the exam and hope to get into one of the specialised public high schools like Stuyvesant, where you will find yourself in class among fiercely competitive East Asian grinds whose parents are post office clerks. Or you can accept that scholarship to St. Cuthbert's Private Academy for Young Gentlefolk and spend 4 years playing lacrosse with Montgomery Talmadge III and Aaron Goldberg, whose parents are investment bankers. A necessary condition for having that choice is that you be black, or at least blackish. Non-blacks need not apply. That, at any rate, is the talk among dissident right types around town. I'd like to see some actual numbers, but it doesn't seem at all implausible that Here, too, black privilege is in play. Fallout from the March 15th killings in New Zealand continues to drift down. The main effect of it all, as far as I'm concerned, has been to trash my entire image of New Zealand. I've mentioned before that my dad spent happy years in New Zealand 90 years ago and transmitted his nostalgia for the place to my infant self. I didn't have much to do with New Zealand thereafter until the early 1980s, when I was doing contract systems development work in London. For some reason, New Zealand was, at that time, a major exporter of computer programmers. I worked with half a dozen of them, all 20 or 30-something young men. They ran to a distinctive type. Their principal characteristic was sportiness. I have never known people so sporty. Rugby was a big thing, of course, but they seemed up for pretty much anything in the sporting line. The only competition water skier I ever met in England was a Kiwi. I knew a keen paraglider too, although I don't remember whether he was competitive. Sportiness aside, these young guys were earthy and fun-loving. One of them, I recall, had a beach party in his London flat. He actually brought in big bags of sand and spread it over the floors. They had a ribald sense of humour, and they were great beer drinkers. After all that, the next memorable encounter with a Kiwi that I recall was with Sue Pocket, the philosopher. Yes, that's right. New Zealand has philosophers. I met Sue at the 2008 Consciousness Studies Conference in Tucson, Arizona. She is a sturdy, square-built lady with a blunt style of speaking. Later, I read her book, The Nature of Consciousness. And in my online diary, I quoted from her introduction to that book. Re-quote. When I first started thinking seriously on this question, about 5 years ago, I had no clue as to what a theory would look like. However, being a New Zealander, and thus imbued from childhood with the notion that I was a rugged individualist who could fix anything with a piece of number 8 fencing wire, I was not as daunted by these obstacles as a more socialized person might have been. End quote. It's hard to believe, and it's sad if true, that a nation of boisterous young sportsmen and ruggedly practical Sue Pockets, solving deep problems in metaphysics with number 8 fencing wire, it's sad that this nation has been sissified and PC-ified into a trembling, emoting, liberal arts campus of safe spaces and bias response teams. That's what seems to have happened, though. Back in those London days when I was working alongside Kiwi programmers in London, the New Zealand Prime Minister was the somewhat Trumpish Robert Muldoon, a figure of much fun among my colleagues. I gave him a passing mention in We Are Doomed, quote, "As late as 1980, I am told, the Prime Minister of New Zealand had his domestic telephone number listed in the phone book. Farmers used to call him up and grumble about the price of sheep dip." End quote. What a falling off there has been. Today's Prime Minister is Jacinda Ardern, whose pictures, much in the news recently, of course, bring irresistibly to my mind the snippy, frigid, over-controlling wife of Alan Harper in that excellent aughties sitcom Two and a Half Men. Ms. Ardern has taken Brenton Tarrant's rampage as an opportunity to unleash all her control freakishness on the people of New Zealand. She's banning guns, censoring the internet, restricting liberties, including freedom of speech, and stepping up the surveillance of citizens. I wouldn't be at all surprised if she hires in the Chi-Coms to impose their social credit system on the nation, complete with facial recognition cameras all over and restrictions on low-credit Kiwis buying plane tickets. There would be a bitter irony in that. Brenton Tarrant admires the Chi-Com system of government. New Zealand seems to have been trending in the direction of control freakery anyway. I did not know until this week's news reports that the nation has a chief censor, an employee of the government's Office of Film and Literature Classification. This bloke, name of David Shanks, has banned possession of Tarrant's manifesto and the video he took of his killings. If either item is found among your belongings, you face 10 years imprisonment. For distributing them, you can get 14 years. These measures are not likely to meet much resistance from young New Zealanders. At any rate, to judge from this report in the New Zealand Herald about an event at a pop concert last Saturday in the capital city, Wellington. Headline: Evacuations of Homegrown Music Festival Reportedly Sparked by a Tattoo. Some concert goer saw this tattoo on the arm of some other concert goer and panicked. The panic spread and the whole venue was evacuated. Quote from the story: It has been reported that the tattoo was thought to be linked to far-right ideology. However, it turned out it was traditional. End quote. Well, thank goodness for that. How distressing it must have been to all the Kiwi snowflakes in attendance, though, to know that there might among them have been a person with a far-right tattoo. I would dearly like to know what exactly the triggering tattoo was, but none of the news outlets want to tell me. Perhaps they fear that an explicit description would bring down the chief censor on them with a 10-year prison sentence. So much for my fantasies of a nation of hearty, sheep-shearing yeomen preserving the old Anglo-Saxon liberties down there in the Antipodes, while those liberties wilt and decay in the Northern Hemisphere homelands. The Kiwis seem actually to be ahead of us in stamping out freedom. I shudder to think what my dad would have said. We are hearing more and more names in connection with the Democratic Party primaries for next year's presidential election. Here are four names that I've chosen for a reason. Andy Yang. Yang is a 44-year-old successful New York entrepreneur who has made universal basic income his signature issue. His policy positions are centre-left. He favours Puerto Rican statehood, for example, but they are eclectic enough to have attracted the support of Richard Spencer. Well, that was at any rate the case until a video surfaced of Yang saying in mid-March quite exceptionally silly things about the danger of rising white hostility against successful Asians. The indispensable Colin Flaherty has the grisly details over at American Thinker. Yang talks a good game on border security, and he takes a strong line, for a Democrat I mean, on illegal aliens. He'd give them citizenship, but only after 18 years. Amy Klobuchar. The 58-year-old senator from Minnesota is being talked up, for example by The Economist, as a safe pair of hands with good electability. Quote from The Economist. In 2018, when she was re-elected as one of Minnesota's senators, she performed vastly better in the state than Hillary Clinton did 2 years earlier. Mrs. Klobuchar is the opponent Mr. Trump would least like to face. End quote. Pete Buttigieg. This is the 37-year-old mayor of South Bend, Indiana, where he grew up. He's climbing in the polls. He's now ahead of Kamala Harris and Elizabeth Warren. He claims to speak seven languages, and he served 7 months in Afghanistan as a lieutenant in the U.S. Navy Reserves, doing counterintelligence work. Buttigieg hasn't said a whole lot about immigration, and the little he said is squishy. He supports DACA, for example. He's a homosexual, married to another guy who has taken his name. The name is of Maltese origin. Given the guy's orientation, the name has attracted some unkind comments, which I decline to engage with. Buttigieg doesn't seem to be the more intolerant, vindictive kind of homosexual, the kind who sues Christian bakers for not baking same-sex wedding cakes. He seems, in fact, to be Midwestern nice, although not with any policy positions that I could vote for. Beto O'Rourke. Yes, then, of course, there is Beto O'Rourke, the 46-year-old Irish-American from Texas with the Hispanic nickname. O'Rourke is as close to being open borders as makes no difference, and of course he supports DACA. O'Rourke is cultivating an image as young for his age and hip, having himself filmed skateboarding and so on. James Antle at The Week allows that he's a gifted public speaker, but says he has an authenticity problem. A sort of latter-day John Edwards, says Antle. Oh dear. Well, those are my four names. Yang, Klobuchar, Buttigieg and O'Rourke. What do they have in common, other than they all want to win the presidency for the Democrats? What they have in common is a dash of diversity. It's the very merest dash in O'Rourke's case, just a smidgen of Hispanic flavour from that nickname. With the others, it's more substantial, although still slight enough to be unthreatening. Buttigieg is homosexual. Klobuchar is female. Yang is Asian American. If I were running the Democratic Party, that's what I'd be looking for in a 2020 candidate. Unthreatening. Not obviously nasty like Kamala Harris. Obnoxious like Cory Booker, crazy like Elizabeth Warren, or geriatric like Bernie Sanders, and with just a dash of diversity. If the Democratic Party hasn't totally lost its mind, that's the kind of candidate they will go for. Although, of course, that's a big if. The news came in on Brexit just as I was going to tape here. Theresa May's wishy-washy deal with the EU bosses was voted down for a third time in Parliament. There is now just 2 weeks to the April 12th deadline and a good possibility of a hard Brexit on that date, one with no deal. I hope that's what happens. There are alternative possibilities, though. Mrs. May might try for a fourth vote. She might call a snap election. The EU might even extend the deadline again. The moral of this horrible, degrading fiasco. Other European nations, please pay heed. The moral is, if your citizens vote to leave an open borders supranational bureaucracy you have foolishly gotten yourself involved with, just leave. Allow perhaps 1 week to pass statutes as necessary, declaring that in future you'll make your own laws and negotiate trade agreements nation to nation. Then leave. There'll be some chaos for a while, but at the end of it, you'll be a nation again, independent and free. That's worth a spell of chaos. I bet Robert Walpole would have done a much better job of Brexit. That's the ration for this week, ladies and gents. Thank you for listening. Now, get out in the garden and plant something. It's April! Well, very nearly. Talking back there about the Kiwi programmers that I worked with 40 years ago, I mentioned that the Prime Minister of New Zealand at that time was a chap named Robert Muldoon. I am sorry to say that my colleague's attitude to Mr. Muldoon fell far short of the respect due to a man of such high position and accomplishment. They didn't hate him in the modern political style, but they were irreverent and sometimes rude about him. It so happened that some years previously, the English comedian Peter Cook had recorded a silly song with the title The Ballad of Spotty Muldoon, about a person afflicted with some unfortunate dermatological condition. Cook did not have Robert Muldoon in mind. That Muldoon was unknown at the time the song was recorded, and so far as one can judge from photographs, the New Zealand Prime Minister was not significantly spotty. My Kiwi colleagues attached the song to him anyway, and down at the pub after work, with a few rounds of beers inside them, they would respond to any mention of him with a lusty rendering of the ballad, accompanied by appropriate hoots and guffaws. As Radio Derb listeners surely know by now, I can't resist a silly song. So, here is Peter Cook from the mid-1960s with The Ballad of Spotty Muldoon. There will be more from Radio Derb next week.
There have been many spotty people in the history of mankind. Some are born spotty, some achieve spottiness, and some have spottiness thrust upon them. But there is one whom heaven has blessed with far more spots than all the rest. His name by now you will have guessed. It is, of course, Muldoon. Spotty Muldoon, Spotty Muldoon. He's got spots all over his face. Spotty Muldoon, Spotty Muldoon. He's got spots all over the place. He's so spotty, Spotty Muldoon. He's got spots where others have not. He's so grotty, Spotty Muldoon. Oh, what a lot of spots he's got. He's unbelievably spotty.